as a way of training yourselves, something that you need to develop over and over again, not only here on this retreat, but when you go home, really practice so that the mind goes towards stillness, towards calm, rather than towards all the confusions of the sensory world. One of the experiences every one of us has to meet is death, death of the body. At some time or another, this is will happen to every one of us. Now the sensory world is the attractive force, what pulls us into rebirth all the time, being pulled out into objects. Therefore, if we just follow that, we just spend our lives just going from one thing to another, just being pulled into objects of sense, then of course we're not at all prepared for the big moment. Really the great opportunity going back to completely to the still center of being, rather than becoming all these different things. And see that meditation is a very skillful means towards becoming more and more familiar with the center of being while the body's still alive. And so you have to train yourself to do, because you the society is certainly not going to help you. The present society is a very foolish society, and it wants to keep you foolish and ignorant. So don't trust the society unless you particularly want to be foolish and ignorant. As you're mindful, you become more and more aware of the stillness, natural stillness, as the very center of being, where we move toward, we become attentive to that, rather than the endless searching among the sense world, the aimless wandering in the sensory world. Contemplating this, you see that the having eyes, for example, if you keep identifying with vision, then of course you're constantly going looking for things. It's very natural, isn't it? To just kind of, we're human beings are very attached to the visual sense. We like colors and forms. We like to go looking at things, televisions and cinemas and picture books and videotapes and endless opportunities, tours to go and just sit in big coaches and look at cathedrals and some people go on these tours of Europe. 14 European cities in 10 days. and you go look at Venice, Florence, Rome, Paris, you know, all over. There's so many things to see. But it is distracting. It's distraction that people are involved in, isn't it? You just, you're going, you're waiting for, you go and see, go and look at Notre Dame in Paris, and then the next thing, what's on the next, what do we see next? Going to the museums in London. As a child, I remember we had one of these art books, the photographs from the National Gallery in London, all these famous paintings. And I used to think, oh, it'd be nice to go to London and see the real thing. So when I arrived in London 9 years ago, I went to the National Gallery. Dream come true, wasn't it? But when you have nothing to look at but one masterpiece after another, it gets pretty boring, doesn't it? You don't have time to really, you don't really notice much. You're just going from one exquisite masterpiece to another. The visual sense is just, we just keep going from one thing to another. That pulls us out. We're always, if that's our purpose for living, our reason for being, then of course when our eyes fail us or a thing like that, then of course there's great sorrow, because we've become so dependent on being pulled into the objects of vision, distracting ourselves endlessly with sight or sound. You can have continuous music with the technology, the best kind of music or the worst, whatever your preference is. You could choose among all the possibilities of sound now available from ancient kind of Egyptian music to modern jazz to acid rock. You can hear it all at once, I suppose. That's distracting. You're always going to sound or taste, isn't it? Just going from eating things. So easy to just buy things with supermarkets now, so readily available in refrigeration, freezers. We can just eat our way through life, waiting for the next thing to eat. Odor's not particularly strong. That's what it is with dogs, you notice. The nose is on the ground and they're very sensitive. But we can smell our way through life. Physical pleasures. This trying to squeeze as much pleasure out of the body as we can get and avoid as much pain. We're trying to get all the pleasure we can out of this body. And now, you see, all the kind of free hedonistic 60s, 70s, where you have wide open liberation for any kind of sexual pleasures you could possibly imagine or want, carried to an extreme, gets, now you find the movements towards asceticism and people training their bodies with weights and doing all kinds of torturous exercise. I was reading about in America where they have these health studios where now young men and women go when they have dates. They kind of go to these health spas and do all kinds of torturous exercises. And they want these incredibly trim bodies. They have to spend so much time kind of exercising them and getting them down to the kind of dimensions that you want. You have to give up this going from one suite to another, where you're no longer just seeking sensual pleasure or bodily pleasures, but you're going on dates to health spas where you're lifting weights together, I suppose. So even physical and trying to push your body to get as much energy out of it as possible. Athletes just taking all kinds of drugs and things that will just develop the body more and more to get more energy and vigor in order to keep pushing. What is it for? Why do we want to keep running and jumping and doing all these things with the body? Then the intellectual pleasures, endless now. Everything's written in books and taped, photographed, recorded. Every possible library is chock-a-block with everything, with tomes of doctoral theses, PhDs and masters, theses on aspects of aspects of aspects of aspects. You can't. Knowledge has become so complicated now that you're just an ordinary kind of information book. Is you have to develop something beyond that. The minutiae of the intellect, we can keep proliferating endlessly into books and tapes. On this trip I took to Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Australia, the craze now is taping and video, making video tapes and photographs. So people they send a video crew with me all over Thailand. I had my own video crew. Wherever I went, I was being videoed in the remote part of northeast Thailand on Phupek Mountain, a place you go to get away from the rat race. My video crew followed me there. By the time I die, there's going to be so many tapes, videotapes, cassette tapes, and pictures. They probably make a mountain out of all these things. I think maybe they should, when I die, they could get all these things together and melt them down, make a big plastic image of me. Noting that the senses, say, when we're moving toward, when we're in the stillness of being, then the senses are calmed. We're not going out towards objects anymore, or seeking aimlessly after just distractions through the senses. You're moving towards the still center of being. And in that, that's a transcendent place. That's a way of being. It's not personal anymore. It's not any more mine than it is yours. It's not. It's why we say anatta, not self, because it, as soon as you claim it as yours, you're being pulled out into an object again, isn't it? As soon as you think, oh, my still center, that very thought is an object of the mind. So to give up the thinking and the grasping and the claiming and the this tendency to keep trying to create a self, we give up all sense of all that desire to become a something rather, or to be something rather, but actually abide in the stillness, the knowing, the clarity, the attentiveness. The sound of silence helps us to abide there more and more, because when you contemplate that sound of silence, then there's no sense of self in that, unless you start thinking that's my sound of silence. But then recognizing that that's just something you're adding to it. It's not it at all, is it? The thought that you might have about it. So you abide in that stillness, in that point of stillness, of being. And when we say anatta, we're not, this Buddhist teaching of anatta is not a kind of doctrinal position. This is where people, so many people misunderstand Buddhism, is that they think Buddhists believe that there isn't any self. What do Buddhists believe in? We believe that we don't have any self. That's not it. We're not trying to believe that we don't exist or there isn't any self here. But as you really contemplate and move towards stillness, then the sense of self as a thing, as an object, is gone, isn't it? There's just the knowing, the clarity. There's not a self as an object, with a name and a form that can change and become something else. If you identified with your body as yourself, then you're going to die, aren't you? When the body dies, that's I'm going to die. My body's dying. I'm dying. People get frightened, don't they? And their bodies start moving toward the grave. I don't want to die, because if you've spent your whole life believing that your body is yourself, then you can't help but be frightened when the body starts dying, because it seems like you're going to die. But in the stillness of mind, being in the stillness, then whatever, the bodies get born and then they die and things arise and cease according to their nature. But there's no need to claim it in any personal way anymore. We've broken through that illusion of mortality as being self, is what anatta means. Nor do we claim immortality as mine. The Buddha was very skillful psychologist, actually. like in Hinduism, they tend to go a little too far by saying there's the big self and the little self, there's the Atman, and they tend to create a metaphysical structure that the Buddha avoided completely. Not to deny that, but to no longer conceive it or feel the necessity or the need to create a concept for ultimate reality or to describe it in any personal way. One of the great problems with the Christians, isn't it, is that their religion has become so personal. It's so everything's personalized, with personal relationships with God, and God is a father. And now the feminist movement says, why does God have to be a father? Why can't God be a mother? They have a point. Male chauvinism, males want to dominate everything so that they've created a paternal God figure. Just that aggressive male chauvinism. Why can't God be a mother? But then you're stuck with the same problem, aren't you? Whether God's a father or mother, the problem is the same. You're stuck with a personal. You're giving truth a quality, and kind of labeling it and giving it a quality as if it were permanently, God was permanently a father or permanently a mother. Absolutely, completely, forever. Then a compromise, maybe God is both father and mother, a kind of hermaphrodite. But that isn't very inspiring, is it? It's a compromise, but it's not terribly inspiring to the mind as a symbol. One can understand these symbols, like the father, the mother, and that as certainly human qualities and perceptions that are very powerful in our minds. Like when we're children, when I was a little boy, and I looked to my mother and father, they were the gods in my life. They were the all-powerful figures. What my father said was true. And he was the god in the house. He could punish me, he could reward me, he could love me, he could hurt me. My mother she had complete power over me. And as a little child, so that from a children's view, mother and father are gods. And they have to be that way. It's not that mother and father are trying to be gods to their children. That's not it at all. But that's for a certain level of consciousness, that's the way it has to be, because a child has to depend on a mother and father. A child can't depend on, it has to actually physically need a mother and a father. Physically and emotionally need them. So it's a necessity when you're a child. When you get older, then you begin to, when you get older, you start seeing that your father might be God in the house, but outside the house he doesn't have much power. You see some weaknesses and you leave and you see their father doesn't have much to say about the way the world is run. He comes home, he can be absolute tyrant and dominate the whole scene, but not outside. So then it's easy to project God as just being a kind of overall father, like your father is the one who's God in the house, and then in the universe is this all-powerful father. And it's a natural kind of projection, isn't it, from a child's mind, from a child's perspective, of a father image. Someone who's like the father, the qualities of a father, what kind of the guide, the righteous judge, the one that makes decisions and sets the standards and rewards and punishes. These are all kind of paternal qualities. And religion keeps people very much, tends to keep people very much on that emotional plane of a child, always looking to a father or a mother. So we're always expecting something from above, isn't it? It can't help. As much as the Christians deny this, it's still a kind of ingrained view that God is an old man up in the sky. I mean, even though we recognize that's a childish view of God, we can't help but when somebody says God, sometimes the image comes of a white bearded old man up in the sky. Why is that? So that the children, the emotions of a child, maybe see God in that way. The perception. So that the personification of truth always it has that limitation. We tend to, whatever we personify, we tend to attach to. View, an opinion about oneself being a personality, my personality, or someone else's personality, or God can have a personality. Reflecting and knowing the still center of being, then personalities come and go and change. We see them as they really are, the personal qualities of ourselves and others. And all these is whether it's love or compassion or the high-minded kind of divine qualities of joy and love and compassion, or just the human qualities of fear and desire and jealousy and greed, hatred, and delusion, they come and go. The feeling of being a man or a woman comes and goes. The identity with race or nationality or class, these come and go in the mind. But that knowing, in the stillness and knowing and attentiveness, we see all these personal qualities as they really are, as sankharas, sape sankharani cha, all conditions are impermanent. All dhamma is not self. If we say all dhamma is self, then That because that's a positive statement, all Dhamma is self, one tends to grasp at a doctrinal position. All Dhamma is self. Everything is self. The ultimate self, the Atman, or everything is Atman. Or I'm everything. One can go on in that vein. But even that is thought, isn't it? So that all Dhamma is anatta, not self, kind of leaves the mind empty. Because when you contemplate that, then any attempt to attach to even the highest ideas or doctrines or metaphysical teachings, any attempt to do that is seen. You can see it. You can see one's attempt to grasp at ultimate statements or the highest concepts that the human mind can form. One can see the grasping of that, and then the abiding in the stillness of being, where one gives up all that desire, even the aspiration to realize the ultimate truth, so that one is being that truth rather than aspiring to become it or realize it. There is the being rather than the becoming. From this still point, one can contemplate these things. One reflects, and the teaching that I'm saying is a reflection, not trying to tell you how it is. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to convert you or convince you of anything, but trying to reflect in a way that you can also reflect and contemplate the way things are. namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. Contemplating the way things are, getting to examine and investigate the mind, to be awake, awakened one, enlightened, realizing nibbana or non-attachment. When we talk about, when we use this word nibbana, it's the goal for our meditation is to realize non-attachment. Because non-attachment is, we are always attached. We tend to attach to things out of ignorance, not understanding things properly. We're always attaching, grasping at everything. And nibbana, experience of nibbana, is when we realize non-attachment. Sometimes this word is translated as extinction, so it sounds rather forbidding, like annihilation. Buddhists believe in extinction. That's pretty heavy. That makes Buddhism sound rather nihilistic. That's not. When you're talking about Buddhism, you can't use all your perceptions about other religions because they don't apply about believing beliefs and these, not that, say, what do Buddhists believe in? This is a common question. People come and say, what do Buddhists believe in? They say, if you say we don't believe, say we don't have belief, and they think you believe in nothing. They know that's not it. We don't believe that there's nothing either. Well, then you believe there's something. You believe in God. We don't feel it's necessary to believe in God. Then you believe there isn't any God. They go around and around like that, because this believing is very much a what people regard as religion, believing in doctrines and theistic positions or atheistic positions. And so the two extremes of the mind, isn't it? Eternality and extinction, or annihilationism. So the Buddhist approach is from a different angle. It's a different way of doing it. It's not, and this is where I think most of us are attracted to Buddhism, because it's a different way of doing it, where we're no longer willing to believe in doctrines or teachings or things that come from others. We're actually wanting to find out the truth. What is the truth of things? If something's true, then it must be available to us. Are we just kind of lost, helpless beings in a mysterious universe without any way of understanding what's happened to us, or why things are as they are? Are we just some kind of cosmic accident? Some kind of explosion in the universe, and the human being suddenly appeared for no reason? Or is our life meaningless without any purpose or meaning? Or is there something more to it? We obviously sense that there is something beyond just the appearance of the sensory world. Always human beings feel, even in primitive societies, tribal people, or we've all had this religious feeling, a sense of movement towards something, or rising up to something, or there's some that's mysterious, a vast mystery that we're involved in some way, and we want to know how to relate to it. What do we do? What can we do in this position we find ourselves, incarcerated in a human body for 60, 70, 80, 90 years? If there's truth, certainly we must be able to open to it and know it. Otherwise, if we're just caught in illusions all the time, then it is a despairing and meaningless and purposeless existence. It doesn't mean anything, and it doesn't matter what you do. It's without any value at all. And that's a nihilistic position. Just total denial. But even though you might choose to accept a nihilistic view, you still don't know, do you? You still can't. You might prefer to believe in that there's no meaning rather than believe that there is. But what is it that we can know now, sitting here in this meditation hall, is that we don't know, that this is the way it is now. The body is here, this is the way it is now. There's knowing, isn't there? There's intelligence. There's an inclination towards the good and the beautiful. There's a withdrawal, a wanting to get away from the painful and the ugly. We find that which is good, beautiful, we want to draw close, be attracted to that, and get away from the painful, the ugly. Human beings have always aspired. There's this sense of aspiration, isn't there? We hate ourselves for living low, indulgent, coarse, ugly lives. We have a sense of shame, don't we? When we do evil, wicked things, or petty and mean things, either through speech or action, we feel ashamed. We feel ashamed of ourselves. We hope nobody knows some of the things we do. Hope nobody can see, nobody knows. If it was totally meaningless and didn't matter, then of course there wouldn't be any need for shame, would there? Do any old thing, what if it doesn't matter. But because there is this sense of shame, a sense of that some things that we can do or that we do are not praiseworthy, are not wise, are not beautiful, not things that we might feel inclined to do at times, or impulses on that level do operate through the mind, but we also aspire to rise above the course, the instinctual movements through the body and mind. You know, just like eating food, we could, if you give some fish and chicken to a cat, it just gobbles it down, doesn't it? It starts going berserk, and then as soon as you put it down, it just gobbles it, chews it up as fast as it can and swallows it. Why don't we do that? Sometimes we feel like it, don't we? We're hungry. We could just gobble food down. I remember going to Hampton Court one time. They used to do that in time of Henry VIII. They're telling me that I was hearing this guide talk in one of the bedrooms where Henry VIII, one of those with these enormous canopied beds. And the guide was telling this group of American tourists, you see, their beds were made like this so that they could sit up and sleep in those days, because they used to be such gluttons, they'd eat and drink so much that if they lie down when they fell, they might die. So they had these beds made where they could sit up. Imagine, can you imagine eating that much food? If you lie down, you die. And that was the king of England. And that wasn't the kind of peasant or the caveman. It was the king, the aristocracy in a beautiful Hampton Court palace. Intelligence, we have intelligence, don't we? We can be quite rational. We can think of the highest concepts. We can conceive in our mind that which is the best and that which is the worst. See that they say liberty, equality, fraternity, a kind of idealism of from the French Revolution. There's been a tremendous influence on, say, that was a kind of change maybe in the world's consciousness, the idea of democratic society or socialism, communism, all these come from thinking in the highest ways about what is the most fair, the most just form of government. Not that our governments ever attain any all that much, but they do try. We have now communism or socialism or democracy or what most people try or pretend they're having, whether they have it or not, something else. Even a tyranny is now called kind of maybe socialism, democratic socialism, or give it some kind of respectable name according to an ideal. You just call it the tyranny. It doesn't inspire people very much. What tyranny do you belong to? What tyrant are we going to elect this year? Just our appreciation for what is refined in aesthetic beauty, in music, in art, poetry, the use of language. All this conveys that in our limited way as a human being, this aspiration towards what is finer, better. In many ways we have, say, humanity now is in a position, say, as a global family. Before it was almost impossible to conceive in any practical way a global family, wasn't it? Maybe we thought in terms of nations. That was used to be the advanced view of life. A nation, the British Empire, was maybe a beginning of a global view, but it was still based on a nation, national view. But now with modern communications and transportation, we now can think practically, in practical terms, about a global family, human family. It's not difficult to go from here to New Zealand or South America or the United States, is it? It's only a few hours by air and you can be anywhere on the planet. So that the vast distances that used to separate one country from another no longer really, not very vast, are they? Yet from here to Sri Lanka in a few hours. 100 years ago it'd take months. What happens now in Mongolia or in Argentina affects everything, so that we're now beginning to come to terms more with a global view. One planet, one kind of ecological system, one human family. All these perceptions now are increasingly common. So we can conceive, and we can expand our ability to perceive from just me and mine, this my life as an individual being, and I've got to look out for myself and see that I have everything for myself to protect myself. I can just live very much as just for myself alone, this creature here, at the expense of everyone else. That's a tyrant, isn't it? To see that I've got everything and I'm secure, even if I have to steal everything from you, the selfishness, to say a global view of a human family where you include all human beings in the family rather than just your immediate family or your national family. We now can expand that perception to all human beings as the family. And that is a practical way of looking at it. Now when we think of, say, the famine in Ethiopia, we think of our family starving to death in Ethiopia. It's different than when you think those foreigners off in Africa, don't matter what happens to them. They aren't ours, they aren't like us. We can be pretty cold and callous, can't we, when we think of them as just foreigners or different race and people that don't matter because they're far away and they're not ours. Or they, as we expand consciousness, then we, even the ability to perceive, to form perceptions and concepts that are much more loving, kindly, compassionate, than just it caring for myself as an individual, or my family, or my group, or my class, or my race, we can expand to include all human beings. And then all beings. If you notice in the Buddhist practice of metta, they don't leave anything out. And you're spreading metta in Karanya Metta Sutta, they don't leave any possible, there's no way, every possible being that you could possibly conceive of is included in that. It's so universal, it's Karanya Metta. There's beings seen and beings unseen. That includes everything, doesn't it? It doesn't say and beings, what could be any kind of beings. Doesn't say human, doesn't say just human beings either. Could be any possible being that you can conceive of, seen or unseen. All the animals that we can see and all the animals we can't see. Like this, so this is taking our ability to perceive and conceive into this very grand universal way of looking at that which surrounds us. We begin to incorporate in just our ability to conceive, make conceptions, we can include everything within that, that we can conceive to that level. We can have a universal concept, or we can have just a selfish concept. The opposite of a universal one is just selfish, me. That's all I care about, just me. Or all gradations in between. Just a very selfish me to the Karanya Metta, all beings, seen and unseen. With the investigating the way things are, rather than looking at, say, or using just concepts and theories and rational thought and logic, we're not trying to just analyze or criticize, just get caught up in going from one concept to another, but using our ability to perceive to point to beyond perception, to just knowing, to just awareness. As you begin to calm down more and more, you begin to feel a sense of a more continuous awareness, something that is firm and stable and constant in just knowing and being alert rather than the concepts, ideas, views, emotions, and all that that come and go. Just try to hold on to a thought for very long and see. Of course, the thoughts that you don't want seem to stay forever, don't they? If you don't want a thought, then it seems to. I mean, it's something kind of perverse about our mind. The thoughts we don't want seem to hang around forever. But then, if you start trying to hang on to those thoughts, you find that they go away. Have you noticed that? I think I'm going to hang on to that horrid thought. It'll go away. It'll disappear. But as soon as you think, I wish it would go away and never come back, then it seems to hang around. That's why you have to have wisdom in this life, otherwise you just get bashed about by your mind. In the morning reflections, we about that yesterday is a memory, tomorrow is the unknown, now is the knowing. Bringing the attention, alertness, to the way it is now, rather than thinking about or everything in the past or planning for the future, worrying about the future. We begin to establish ourselves in the present. This is the way it is. Now this, what they use, called suchness or as-isness, when in the moment as it is now, this is the way it is. Now to, when I say this, just note what happens to your mind when they, this is the way it is now. I'm not pointing to any object, am I? I'm not telling you how it is or how you should see it or feel it or experience it. I'm not telling you what you should be experiencing or not pointing to any object or anything at all or describing it in any way, but just saying this is the way it is now, the suchness as it is now. So that this is what happens to my mind when I use this thought. I open the mind. Suddenly I'm just feel more with the moment, opening to it, rather than looking for something to fix on. I'm not trying to describe the moment, but just open to it. And so the mind can go quite empty, quite the thought process stops and the mind opens. This is the way it is. Then we can reflect accordingly at this time the way it is. There's the breathing, sound of silence, there's a body here, there's feelings in the body, there's breathing, there's silence, the time is now, the place is here. This is the way it is. So in this opening of the mind, there's no judgment, no criticism, no preference. We're not saying we like it or dislike it, we're just open to it. And we begin to feel at ease in just being with the way things are, rather than always having to attach to them and hold on to them or reject them or criticize them or ignore them or whatever. We begin to feel a sense of ease and peacefulness with just being with life as it is, rather than thinking that we have to do anything about it. When I'm sitting here, the suchness of the moment just is this way. I know there's no immediate danger. There's not like a bandits attacking the meditation center or poisonous snakes running around in the meditation hall or wild tigers, anything dangerous, isn't it? So I don't have to, my instinct for self-preservation isn't active at this moment. Well, suddenly a wild tiger came into the room, the suchness of the moment would be that our sense of self-preservation would be activated. We wouldn't be just sitting here contemplating the suchness, would we? Something else would happen. If you ever felt when your life is in danger, instinctual self-preservation starts operating, and you find yourself doing things quite that even amaze you. Remember the when I was a youth, the idea of being a conscientious objector was very difficult in those days to be considered a conscientious objector. And they'd ask you questions like, what would you do if a maniac attacked your mother? And then you were supposed to answer that question. You're sitting here, your mother's not here. Sometimes you think the person asking the question might be a maniac, but you can't. There's nothing here that you can relate to. Say that. What would you do now if a maniac attacked my mother? I'll ask you that question. You don't even know my mother. Maybe she's a maniac. So you start speculating. Well, if you're determined to convince people you're a conscientious objector, then you say, well, I'd just pray. And they say, you mean you just let that man stab your sweet little old mother? And say, well, if I'd stop him. And say, you're not a conscientious objector. You're not a pacifist. If I should ask you, what would you do if you were in a little room with an angry snake, poisonous, deadly poisonous snake? You could speculate. Should you kill the snake? Would that be, if you're a Buddhist and you're not, and you've taken the Bodhidharma precept? If you're in your bedroom and this angry cobra comes in, should you kill it or not? Or should you let it kill you? Should you let it bite you? And what should you do? There's always speculate about this. But actually what happens is that when these things happen, you don't, there's no question in your mind about what to do. So that you have to trust in the instinct for self-preservation. So if a maniac attacks my mother, and I'm around, I trust that the wisdom of the moment will direct me to do the right thing. Let the maniac attack her and kill her. I can't say I'd do that. I can't do what? Because you don't know all the things affecting that moment. You only speculate. You say, what would you do if a maniac attacked your mother? Well, maybe at that time, maybe my mother might have a heart attack and just die anyway. Or maybe the maniac will have an epileptic fit. Could happen. That's fair enough. If you're speculating, you might as well. Or maybe at that time the maniac will suddenly think, I can't harm this sweet little old lady. This, her son over there is a pacifist. He can't protect her. Or maybe one's mother has become a karate expert. Gives him a chop. Or the police come, or who knows what can happen. The telephone rings, or the chandelier falls on his head. That's fair enough, isn't it, to just go on speculating about all the possible things that might happen in a moment which is very unlikely that such a thing will ever happen anyway. In all these years, 52 years, That's never been a problem that I've ever had to face. So it's a silly question, isn't it? It's, all you can say is we don't know. Right now, the situation is such that we don't know what we do, because none of those conditions are present. But we can know the way it is now, can't we? That this is the way it is now. There's no immediate danger. There's no tiger, snake, maniac that we know of. Bandits, communists. There's nothing around threatening us, so we can sit here. We don't feel that our life is endangered at this moment. We've all taken the precepts. We've all said bana dibata, adina dana, that you're not going to steal or kill each other. So we recognize that in the human society at this time, this place, there's a certain amount of trust. We can trust each other to a certain degree, even though maybe we don't know each other that well. Everybody here doesn't know each other intimately and all that well, or the history of our lives. But the situation is such that we feel a certain amount of respect and trust and confidence that sitting here is all right. We've had, right now, we say the weather was fairly mild today. We had a meal to eat. The kind of necessities of life have been provided. So we don't have to spend the time right now trying to just find something to eat and survive and protect ourselves on just the level of survival. We have the time now to contemplate. So with this suchness, this is the way it is. We're bringing into our mind the way it is. We can be aware of then of the things that come up in our mind. While we're sitting here with no immediate dangers, with having had enough to eat and in a warm room, safe, without feeling sick or having any great problems of the moment, say, in any external or physical way, we can be aware of all the things we might be creating, all the memories and thoughts and worries and fears and doubts and anxieties and fantasies and whatnot that we can project onto the moment. When I contemplate the suchness, otherwise this is the way, this clock is like this. The mind is open. The eye is in contact with the clock. The mind's empty. And I can think, this clock is, I start criticizing it. These digital clocks and all this kind of modern technology, Chip, and not like the good old Swiss clocks from long ago. These cheap clocks, quartz clocks and all that, just the technology now, you can just throw them away. No value anymore, not like clocks used to be. And getting carried away with views and opinions about clocks. Or maybe I really like this. It's a really nice citizen clock. It's got digital numbers, and it's got an ordinary kind of clock face that you can see even without my glasses. I press the button, and there's the date. It says April Fool's Day. it says 1st of April. And then I can press it again, and there's the alarm, 3 o'clock in the morning. How did that get there? 3 o'clock in the morning. Then there's a chime I could turn on every hour if you wanted it to go beep beep every hour. But it's off, because I'm afraid it might give you some, bring aversion into some of your minds if it went beep beep every hour. And then there's the 24-hour time, and if I press this button here, it goes just the ordinary time. I press it back to 24-hour time. I'm absorbed into the clock, isn't it? But as it is, it's just this way. You don't even have to think of it as a clock or digital or chip or anything else connected. It's just this way. The mind, there's the suchness of the moment as is. So then it's the we begin to see that everything is as it is. It has no name other than when we give it a name. In itself, it's just as it is. And then we give it, we call it something. We give it a value. We say, this is good, or this is bad. But in itself, it's only as it is. And this is beautiful or ugly. It's not absolute, is it? It's just as it is. All these people in this room, it's just as they are. We can give them names, and we can give them, describe them, whether we like or don't like, or attracted or repelled, or that's something we add to, we project, we create onto the moment. But as it is, it's just this way. So the mind, in this way of reflecting, is wide open, totally accepting, fully open, all-pervading mind, open to the way it is. And from this, then we begin to see that which we add, that which we create onto the moment, out of our habits, fears, desires, karma. Now this is very important for you to contemplate the way things are, the way it actually is in the moment, and then you can be aware of what you project onto it. Now in the suchness of a moment, one can say, one is totally aware of movement, of what's ever happening. We're not incapacitated in any way, but we're with, completely with it. Open rather than fixed on any object. We're aware of that which we create, what is created and what is just the way it is. For example, the body here. This body is just this way. This is the way it is. From having been born and lived 52 years, it's this way. And then I can create something about it. I don't like it, or I like it, or I wish it were looked differently, or I wish I were younger, or I wish I wasn't getting so wrinkled and old looking, or I wish I still had my hair. I create all kinds of views and opinions about the body, but as it is, it's just the way it is. It feels this way. It looks this, it's this way. It's the suchness. But then the habit formations come in, and whether we like it, don't like it, want it to be otherwise. And that's something we project onto the moment. So the Buddha pointed always to this Pachubana Dhamma, the here and now Dhamma, the way things are. It doesn't mean we're aware of the beauty, the ugliness, the way things are, But we're not making anything, we're not creating anything out of it. We can be aware of an imperfection without making any problem about it. In other words, we begin to open, the mind becomes an embracing mind, something where all things can come and go, where we can reflect, we can learn, we can understand the way out of suffering by being completely with life as it's happening, rather than trying to find a way out of suffering by running away from everything in order to protect ourselves and defend ourselves from all possible forms of danger, of violence, insecurity. That's what we think, oftentimes what people think monks do, is we're running away from life, hiding away, because we can't face the real world. And that's probably how it looks to many people. But in actual fact, in actual experience, it's the opening of the mind to embrace the whole, where all of it, the good, the bad, the beautiful, the ugly, pleasure and pain, can be as they are. And one is no longer deluded by the appearance, by the way things seem to be. Because we have this ability, this Buddha-like ability to see things as they really are. So the Buddha's teaching is a teaching pointing to that all conditions are impermanent. Because this is all conditions, sabbe sankhara anicca, all conditions are impermanent. So then we begin to contemplate, what are conditions? What are sankharas then? What do we mean by sankharas? What are conditions? Before that, we've just reacted. We think, I like this condition, I don't like that. We don't even think of them as conditions. We can think of them as kind of absolute realities. This person is absolutely this way. When we have a view about somebody, we can carry that view wherever we go, as if that person were permanently one way all the time. After 20 years, we still, did you know Mavis? Yes, she was that woman that had a inferiority complex. Maybe that was 20 years ago. Mavis said, I think maybe I have an inferiority complex. You haven't seen her since then. She's become an arahant. Completely liberated from all delusion. But when Venerable Amaro says, whatever happened to Mabel? That woman who had the inferiority complex. Because perception is like that, isn't it? We can fix prejudices are like that. You have fixed views about people. Racial prejudices or national prejudices. Class prejudices. They're all coming from that, holding a fixed position about a group of people or a person, as if it was completely and absolutely true all the time. And that is, of course, ignorance. That is, and that ignorance breeds conflict, breeds fear into the world. But in the suchness of the moment, there's no race, there's no class, nationality, these things. Maybe we can use at appropriate times for communication, but they're not ultimately real. They're not absolutes in our minds. So that we're not fixing on any objects as if they were absolutely one way. Fixed with a name, a description, forever. The mind is open and clear, allowing all things to be as they are. so that men and women, Jews and Gentiles, Buddhists and Christians, Asians and Europeans, Africans, working class, middle class, upper class, all these things are only things that go through the mind. They're not actually, we don't see them anymore as absolutes, fixed views on life. We might use these words at appropriate times. I mean, filling out a form, they ask my name. So I don't say anatta. Entering Britain, you have to fill out this form. Christian name. I could say, I'm not a Christian. No name. Nobody. But then that would make it difficult to enter the country, wouldn't it? They think I was really kind of a nut. They say, sex, male or female. I don't identify with sex. I'm neither. But for the sake of communication, I put the right answer down, the question. For it, not because it's an absolute view I have about myself, but just for it's for communication alone, convention. We give our due to convention, but we realize it is only that. It is not absolute. So we, in this way, our mind is no longer fixed in any kind of view, opinion. Views and opinions are seen as conditions that arise and cease in the mind, because that's what they really are. All conditions are impermanent. They arise and they cease. Then the Buddhist teaching, sape tamma anatta, all tamma is not self. This is a little more advanced. All tamma is not self. It's much easier to see all conditions are impermanent. All tamma is not self is, as we meditate more and more, contemplate and see into the nature of things, and this teaching, all tamma is anatta, becomes clearer for us. This sense of not self, of not being anything or any condition, that need to identify and belong to some condition, some view, some position, falls away. We're no longer looking for ourselves or trying to find a name for ourselves, or trying to identify ourselves with anything whatsoever. The freedom, the liberation from attachment to a view, opinion, to a condition, to a sankhara. So then there is dhamma, or the truth of the way it is. So this word, this word dhamma becomes more and more meaningful to us, more useful as a reflection. Because dhamma includes everything. Both the conditions, the unconditioned, mortal, immortal. We're not taking sides anymore. We're not rejecting mortality by holding on to a concept of immortality anymore. But as we free ourselves from attachment to mortality, then, of course, what's left? if you're no longer attached to mortal to mortality, then that must be immortality, isn't it? The unconditioned. Now, in a moment, as it is now, this moment, what could that actually be, unconditioned at this moment? We begin to feel, or begin to be in that mode of unconditioning, not being conditioned, not being attached. There's clarity, there's knowing, but there's non-attachment. You can know that. That's something you can know. You can know nibbana. You can know samsara. Samsara is where you're attached and you're suffering. You're in the samsara. You know, I wish I didn't think like that. I wish those problems would go away. I don't want this. I'm afraid of that. I don't like this. And I shouldn't be this way, or I shouldn't think like that, or you shouldn't, you should. That's samsara. All those screaming, possessive, frightened, greedy little things that go on. And when you're attached to all that, that's samsara. When you're identified with it, that's samsara. You're attached to the body, to the conditions of mind, the samsara and its suffering. Samsara is the realm of suffering. The nibbana is non-attachment. There's non-attachment. There's no attachment, no need, no inclination to identify with the five, what they call the five aggregates, the five khandhas, the body, the feelings, perceptions, conceptions, consciousness. These are as they are. The body is as it is. It's not a rejection or an annihilation of the human body, nor of the mental conditions, but it's seeing them as they are. They arise and they cease. They begin and end. There's no longer, from ignorance, the need to identify and attach to the five khandhas. Realizing the bliss of non-attachment is nibbana, the realization of nibbana. So that these two can be definitely known here and now, samsara and nibbana. So nibbana is not a kind of ethereal state out in the sky or in outer space or in the next life. The Buddha was pointing always to the way things are now, to what can actually be known and realized by each one of us in the limitations we find ourselves as human beings at this time and in this place. Now, this is where your reflection and looking into the nature of things is so, it needs to be developed so that you begin to really know this truth rather than just speculate about it or guess or believe or disbelieve. The way of knowing the truth, direct knowing, not knowing about or believing in somebody's ideas of truth, but actually knowing the real thing. So I offer this for your reflection for this evening.
Sadhu Karanda Dhamma Sri